Hey everybody, welcome to Willie's World. I'm Willie. This episode 14 of Willie's World, is about multiculturalism, immigration, California, and what I call the royal scam. The intro music was from a Steely Dan album called The Royal Scam in the 1970s, and this was the single of the same name from that album. And they were talking about essentially mass migration from Puerto Rico to New York City that was occurring in the 70s, and the results of that they witnessed by living in the neighborhood at one point in time where most of these people lived. So they saw the scam part of it. And royal comes from who's doing the scamming? Who's creating the scam? Well, I would suggest that in California, it's the state legislature. With a little help from local governments, the implementation of liberal policies over a 50-year period or so has pushed the agenda of multiculturalism to its furthest degree, further than any other state. And, I'm living in it. Let me tell you, it's a mess. So royal is the royalty, the elite, the in government. And the scam is basically that multiculturalism isn't anything like what it's sold to be, which is the answer to all of our problems, the answer to economic problems, the answer to social problems. And in fact, it creates many of those problems. So let's see, let's make a case for this, starting with a person by the name of Thomas Sowell, who's a author of 35 books, a professor at Stanford University, and a hero to a lot of young conservatives. His expertise is economics, so this is going to be from an economic point of view. So listen to the short clip of Thomas Sowell being interviewed by Tucker Carlson.
In his new book, Intellectuals and Race, renowned author and economist Thomas Sowell explores the ideas that high-profile figures have had about race and multiculturalism throughout history. And in this new book, Sowell breaks new ground on a variety of racial issues and examines why race relations in America today are the way they are. Joining us now to talk much more about his book, his author and economist, and frankly, hero to many, Thomas Sowell. Mr. Sowell, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Multiculturalism has not only taken root in schools, I think it is uncritically accepted by a lot of Americans, haven't thought it through. In this book, you assault it head on. You describe it as a barrier to progress and a lot of other things. Explain why multiculturalism, if you would, is bad.
I guess it starts from a false premise, which is that there's something that all cultures are equal in some undefinable sense, which has never been the case. I mean, some cultures are better at some things, worse at other things. And at particular times in history, one group's culture may be ascendant, and another time another group's. But what you almost never see is what they assume is a norm, namely all groups performing pretty much the same in all kinds of fields across the board. That you can go through centuries of history without finding a single example of that.
You say that assumption, in fact, holds different groups down. You write, quote, "Multiculturalism, like the caste system, paints people into the corner where they happen to have been born, but at least the caste system doesn't claim to benefit those at the bottom."
Absolutely. So when the multiculturalists say, for example, that the school should not try to make black students speak standard English, the difference between speaking standard English and not speaking standard English can be huge in terms of your job, your careers, and all sorts of other things.
So tell me how it's changed. You've had a remarkable academic career. You've written 35 books. You've taught at the most prestigious universities in the world. I don't think you grew up in a family where that was going to be expected. I don't think your dad was a college professor. How was your education different from the education kids are receiving now?
I get, it was better. That's the straight answer. I went to school in Harlem, but even if you went to school in Harlem in the 1940s and you were in one of the better classes, because they did have ability grouping throughout the system, you got a very good education that would enable you to go anywhere. Some years ago, someone at Forbes said that it was remarkable that I come out of the Harlem schools and went on to these universities. It was not that unusual. In fact, someone who lived about three blocks from me in Harlem sent me a letter, said, my gosh, in this one tenement, you know, we had a college professor, a priest, a doctor, and a lawyer when this fellow was growing up. So this was not that unusual. Now, those avenues upward are simply not there.
Now, but what was the difference, if you could put a point on it? What did your teachers teach you or not teach you that allowed you, and it sounds like other people on your block, not a rich area, to succeed?
First of all, they taught us the English language. They taught us the standard academic subjects. They were not teaching us, tree hugging. They were not teaching us how to use condoms. They were not teaching us to be victims. And they held us to the same standards that they held other kids to. Now, those of us who came from homes where there were no truly educated people, it was a little harder on us. But that's nothing compared to how hard it was going to be if they had made allowances and lowered the standards for us.
Yes. This book is packed with all kinds of interesting information that I had never heard before. This really jumped out at me. You talk about the grotesque, really, disparity between black and white unemployment rates. The black unemployment rate is much higher than the white unemployment rate, but you say that wasn't always the case. You say black labor force participations were higher than that of whites up until about 1930.
Yes.
Changed?
What changed was that the government intervention in the labor market. 1930 was the last year in which there was no federal minimum wage. They brought in the Davis-Bacon Act. In fact, some of the sponsors of the Davis-Bacon Act said that they were producing that act precisely because blacks from the South, construction workers, were coming up north, and the construction companies were able to underbid the northern companies and get government contracts. And so this was meant to put a stop to that.
Amazing. So just to be totally clear, up until 1930, under the Roosevelt administration, and that would have been the Hoover administration, but up until that point, there were lower unemployment rates in black neighborhoods than white neighborhoods. And that has been the result, do you think, of lack of government intervention?
Not always, but in 1930, that was certainly the case. And that was not the first time that it was the case. The huge gap that you see today, that all has occurred under minimum wage laws.
Huh, remarkable. What's the future of affirmative action? You write at some length about that. Will it continue?
Oh, good. It all depends upon whether the Supreme Court wants to give a clear decision one way or the other, or whether they want to do what they've been doing now for more than 30 years, saying pious things so that you can't have quotas, but then leaving wiggle room so that you really can't have quotas so long as you don't call them quotas.
Huh. Do you think, you often hear people say, well, affirmative action may be unfair, but it's helped a lot of people. You buy that?
It may have helped some people, but on net balance, I don't believe it has. There's a marvelous study done showing that when they banned banned affirmative action in California, University of California system, blacks began to graduate at a much higher rate than before, graduate with much higher grade point average, graduated in subjects like math and engineering to a far greater extent than before, because now the students went to those particular parts of the university system that fitted their particular academic preparation, and they graduated. Before, you know, you could flunk out of Berkeley or UCLA,
right,
which does you no good. Now you can graduate from Davis or Santa Cruz and go on to a career.
Amazing. Fascinating. Thomas Sowell, thanks so much for joining us. The book is Intellectuals in Race and well worth reading. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Mark Stein is a best-selling author of numerous books, one of the more recent ones being called America Alone, and he writes a lot about multiculturalism, in particular the effects of the implementation of multiculturalism ideas in Europe and Scandinavia. For example, like in Sweden, it's estimated that by the year 2050, Swedish people will be in the minority. I mean, just think about that. Amongst other points he makes is that all cultures are not equal. But give a listen to an excerpt of Mark Stein talking about multiculturalism.
We're back on the Michael Koren Show. Mark Stein, the author of America Alone, The End of the World as We Know It. Multiculturalism is, and you brought that up in reference to Quebec, because it is a part and parcel of what Canada is, and what you say is part and parcel of what is wrong with Canada to a great extent. Can you articulate to people who haven't heard you talk about it before why multiculturalism in your I don't know whether you've used the word fraud, but I don't think you as far from what you think.
No, I think it is. I mean, I'm basically not in any doubt that most people, given the choice, want to live in an advanced Western society. That's why the immigration movements are from Yemen to Europe. There's not a lot of Scandinavians who want to live in Yemen. Even leftists who profess to believe in multiculturalism use the term the developing world. In other words, their assumption, even when they talk about these countries, is that they're developing towards something closer to Europe or North America. So I think the idea that all these cultures are equal and equally valid isn't true. There's one particular relatively narrow form of civilizational inheritance that delivers greater prosperity, greater opportunity, better health, better for you opportunities for you to live your full human potential than any other society. So to essentially pretend that there's no difference is
absurd. Who gets to be the arbiter over which are more equal than others, though?
Well, that's the point, isn't it? I think multiculturalism arises from the who are we to say? Who are we to say that the common law inheritance of Canada is better than the tribal law of this particular patch of jungle in the middle of nowhere? We feel bad about saying that, so instead we pretend that it's everything is all the same and everything is equal, but it's not equal. The fact is that common law is a better form of justice than Islamic law as practiced in Saudi Arabia, and there shouldn't be anything wrong with saying that.
But if somebody comes back at you after saying that and says, That is an opinion, back that up with fact, how do you argue that?
Well, actually, oddly enough, when you do back it up with facts, when you point out, for example, that if you're a woman and you're raped in many Islamic countries, you get punished. You get punished. You are the one who has brought dishonor on your family. The victim gets punished. So you bring up facts like that. You bring up the lack of women's rights in Islamic countries or whatever. And then people say, well, that's just your opinion. No, there are objective measurements by which you can look at freedom in society. You look at whether you've got property rights, mm-hmm. whether you've got a justice system that works, whether you've got a political culture that isn't tribal. And those are objective measurements on which you can measure the health of society.
If you're saying then that multiculturalism fails, the parts of the world which we have problems with right now, whether it be Saudi Arabia, whether it be Syria, nothing multicultural about them. The only countries that are truly think of themselves as multicultural are Canada, the United States, the Western nations. Is that not the reason why people want to come here?
No, I think that's you're right. Multiculturalism is a unicultural phenomenon. You can't go and go to Saudi Arabia and be multicultural. You've got to do it in North America, Europe, Australia.
It's what sets us apart, right?
Yes, but it's not why people move here. I don't believe when you take, say, the great George Jonas, who was my fellow columnist at the National Post, Canada's greatest public intellectual in many ways. George Jonas came here from communist Hungary. He didn't come here. He didn't move to Canada because he wanted Canada to be more like communist Hungary. That was the reason he left communist Hungary. He came to Canada because it was one of the few countries on the planet that can boast almost half a millennium of sustained relatively peaceful constitutional evolution, and before that, a legal and political inheritance going back to Magna Carta 800 years ago. He knew what he was moving to, and he didn't move to Canada to make it more like communist Hungary.
But I know a lot of people who came for the other reason, because they knew they would be accepted here, because they knew that their culture wouldn't be frowned upon. And I'll grant you, if we were to take our culture to another part of the world, it wouldn't be accepted, and we know that. But it is accepted here. And so
yes, but I think it's a question of what are you accepting? I mean, just to take the Hungarian example, none of us mind if you live in a boring small town. And you're sick of having ham and rye at the diner every night, year in, year out, for decades. And a Hungarian restaurant opens up across the street, and you can have goulash. That is great. That is terrific. That is the best kind of multiculturalism. I'm in favor of cross-cultural commingling. Some of my favorite words, for example, just as a writer, it is amazing how many words I really like come from Indian, come from India, pajamas, veranda, jodhpurs. It's amazing how in that relationship that goes back hundreds of years between England and India, India had an impact on the English language and culture in all kinds of interesting ways. I think when one actually fetishizes multiculturalism and cultural relativism, you lose the ability to understand where to draw the line.
Because
and
this
that's
is where,
dangerous.
This is where I think you've been misunderstood to a lot of people, because I think a lot of people think you say that multiculturalism does not work, so we shouldn't have it. But you're talking about cultural commingling, you call it.
Yes, and I'm happy for that. I mean, I think multiculturalism is a cult of, by and large, a cult of ignorance. I'm astonished, you know, that if you label yourself a multiculturalist, it absolves you knowing anything about any other cultures. Ask a multiculturalist what the capital of Nepal is, or ask him about the principal exports of Malaysia or whatever. It absolves you from having to know anything about other cultures. And because of that, it actually, if everything is all the same, if everything is just as good and as bad as each other, who are we to say when we hear, for example, that Muslim polygamists in Ontario are claiming separate welfare checks for each of their wives? We sort of can't figure out, why is that wrong? Why is that wrong?
We'll come back in just a moment.
There were some striking facts for me in the Mark Steyn's book, America Alone. Here's one. Every Western woman in the European Union is producing an average of 1.4 children, and every Muslim woman in the same union is producing 3.5 children. So he makes a point in his book about how demographics is one way of causing a revolution, not just violently, but just by sheer numbers. I had the experience of being in Paris half a dozen times, maybe close to a dozen times in the 1980s, and one of the things about Paris was their subway system was meticulous, the infamous Metro. It was so clean, and there were artwork all over the place that you could literally eat off the floor. That was in the 1980s. 20 years later, I go back to Paris in the same Metro, armed guards with dogs are patrolling the subways. Dramatic change. Bland statistic you heard a lot of in news reports, about 10% of France's population is Muslim. Give or take a million here, a million there, that's a broadly correct 2005 statistics as far as it goes. But the population spread isn't even. And when it comes to those living in France age 20 and under, about 30% are said to be Muslim. And in the major urban centers, about 45%. If it came down to street-by-street fighting, the combatant ratio in any ethnic war would thus be 1-1. Think about that. For starters, the border needed to be kept wide open as possible. And having Barack Obama in the White House helped a lot with DACA and enforcing the migration laws as little as possible and as slow as possible. Remember, the real agenda here is to create a large number of new voters to keep power, or as it turns out, to take back power. Once they are in the country, there is little chance they will ever be deported, thanks to catch and release. But how will the new batch of voters be educated, you ask yourself? You can't take the chance of them becoming independent thinkers, so they need to be indoctrinated in liberalism and progressivism. But how will they be able to pay tuition, since they are actually not only out of state, but out of the country? No worries. The Democrats come to the rescue. Listen to the interview with Judge Napolitano on Fox.
100% correct. They have to be stopped at Mexico's southern border, because once they get in Mexico, Mexico just wants to get rid of them. It'll either send them south or send them north to Texas. So the help that this fellow's talking about is help that has to be given before they enter Mexico. And by the way, they do enforce their border laws, and they do have the resources with which to do it, and they are not interested in humanitarian needs. It's a different world.
Part of this appropriations bill limited the number of beds that we can have to incarcerate. So this catch-and-release program that the president is so frustrated with is limited because Congress limited the number of beds, so that all of a sudden you have an influx of 1,000, and you've only got 50 beds.
Don't we have a Republican president and a Republican Congress?
You're right.
President Schumer.
And then, that's amazing. And then there's California. The University of California system approved an increase in tuition for out-of-state students. So out-of-state students seeing their college tuition go up, it will not apply to students who are illegal immigrants. The state allows them to enroll as in-state students, Judge. Once again, protecting illegals.
I am not surprised at this in California, but California law, just to be clear, requires that the illegal immigrant have resided in California for 3 years. So if I were 19 years old and wanted to go to UCLA and wanted the in-state tuition break, I'd have to establish residence in California, just as illegal aliens do. But if I'm outstate, if I live in New Jersey and I want to go to UCLA, I've got to pay the full boat. Bottom line, this encourages, this is the president's beast in the night. This encourages the use of state resources, the richest state in the union, sorry, Andrew Cuomo, to encourage illegals to come there and stay there.
It's not just state resources, they're federal resources.
Correct.
Boom.
Correct.
Boom, drop the mic. That's correct. The issue, because they
and
can act like that they support.
Could have been addressed in this monumental monstrosity of a spending bill that the president signed as well.
And there's no must-pass piece of legislation until September. So we're
stuck with this till September.
Nothing's going to pass.
And a new state law that prevents law enforcement from working, even saying a word to an immigration enforcement
agent. That's being challenged.
I don't understand why the president would have signed this. One of the County Board of Supervisors Vice Chair Sean Nelson, the Orange County County Board of Supervisors Vice Chair. He was on Fox News Sunday yesterday, and this stat just struck me and took my breath away. We had 244 people as of last week released that we could not stop, and our people could not tell ICE that we believe ICE would have wanted to speak with them and likely wanted to do something about it.
Our colleague Stuart Farney says to me, do you think California will secede from the union? And I said, yes, but only after Orange County secedes from California.
Well, here was my idea. Somebody needs to take a hacksaw and saw that state off at the border and kick it into the Pacific Ocean. We'll see what happens when they lose all the federal support that they've got.
This is what happens when you pass a 2,000-plus page bill in less than 48 hours and spend $1 trillion.
I guess they're all speed readers, your former colleagues.
Yeah,
2,000
right.
pages and
yeah,
48
right.
hours.
I didn't vote for it.
Nobody read it. They can read. They can speed read, but they lack guts.
They can speed spend.
They definitely can do that. Judge, good to see you. Thanks so much.
Hey, but wait a second. Illegal aliens can't vote, can they? They don't even, in many cases, have acceptable IDs. Hey, how about we allow them to get driver's licenses? After all, wouldn't that increase safety for our citizens on the roads? Oh, how about this? When they get their driver's licenses, we can register them to vote. But they had to say they are citizens when they do vote. What are we going to do about that? Tell them to say yes. But talk to a Democrat about this, and they will talk about voter disenfranchisement to deflect from the obvious. Give a listen here to Laura Ingraham from The Angle interviewing Ann Coulter.
Under new California law, people will be allowed to register to vote, and it'll happen actually automatically when they obtain or renew their driver's license, regardless of whether they're U.S. citizens. As leftist politicians import voters, they still don't seem to understand that there are actually dangers when this happens. And the latest evidence, an illegal immigrant Uber driver was arraigned just yesterday. He's alleged to have raped and robbed four young women in San Luis Obispo. Let's get into this now with New York Times bestselling author Ann Coulter in New York. And here in studio with me is Jose Aristimuño, who's a former deputy national press secretary for the Democratic Party. Jose, let's start with you on this. Registering people to vote who are here illegally. Explain that one to me.
Well, let's be clear here. This policy that's going to be implemented in April, this is what's going to happen. Voters, if you are in the country and you're undocumented, you can gain a driver's license in California.
Right, you already
can
do that.
Right, but there are federal limitations, including you cannot register to vote if you're an undocumented immigrant in California. And they were very clear. The state of California has been very clear. You will not be eligible to vote if you're an undocumented immigrant. It's that simple.
And why is the big fuss if that's all it is? You'll be eligible, but you can't vote.
Yes, illegal aliens are big rules followers. Even before California was issuing driver's licenses to illegals and automatically registering them to vote, there are big Hispanic organizations and leftist organizations generally in California in the 90s that managed to steal an election from Bob Dornan. They found hundreds of illegally registered to vote illegal aliens who were voted for. Already 60%, or about 60% of all ballots in California are sent in by mail. It's not even the illegal aliens who need to go and vote. Don't worry, they'll be voted for. You just need them registered to vote.
Why did Trump close that voter commission? Because the states would not cooperate. You know, the voter fraud commission, they made a big deal of it. The left kind of mocked him, and then they closed it. Was that because states just wouldn't give the information, or they couldn't find any evidence, or what was it?
I'm not sure, but I don't think it was a good idea, except that I think it might have just been moved to an official investigation with the Department of Justice. Incidentally, because of California's giving driver's licenses to illegal aliens, people are always saying, oh, it's so burdensome for people to have to get an ID in order to vote. Well, now all legal residents of California are required to now get a secondary ID in addition to their driver's license because of a federal law that says, hey, all of you states that are issuing phony ID laws, we need a real one now. So there's now the real driver's license you have to go into the inner circle of hell and register for all over again. And when they start giving that to illegal aliens, they'll have to have the real ID. So they don't mind burdening their citizens that way. But yes, this is all about voting. Illegal immigration, legal immigration, but certainly illegal immigration, DACA, it is 100% about voting. At least California makes it clear.
It's not
true. Go ahead.
Everything she's saying, it's false. The reality here is that this new policy that's been implemented in California, what is happening here, this is about democracy. This is about registering people to vote. There are 4 to 5 million people in California who are eligible to vote, and we need to get them registered. That is about democracy. It's not about the undocumented the community. It's about the United States of America.
Every two new immigrants to the United States, on average, sponsor about 7 family members. So we're not talking about spouses and minor children. That's always been respected in time-honored tradition in American immigration. But what the president is very concerned about is that of the million green cards that are given out every year, annually, more than 400,000 of those are this kind of extended family chain migration. Now, I know you originally came from Venezuela or your parents came from Venezuela, but that's a minor child with parents. We're talking about uncles, cousins, and most Americans are against that. That's going to be a big part of this ongoing immigration debate. Where do you stand on this?
Look, that's fine. We can negotiate. The Democrats have been trying to negotate with the president every single day.
Well, Chuck Schumer just took the wall off the negotiating table. That's gone. He just agreed to it. Now he took it off.
Look, you want to talk about somebody who's on, off all the time? That's Donald Trump. We don't know what he's saying about immigration.
Well, he just won. What do you mean? He just won the whole debate on this.
Well, he shut down the government. We know that he said before that this will be good for America to shut down the government.
He didn't shut down the government. He actually won the whole debate.
He shut the government.
A majority of Americans
know that this was the government's fault.
That's why the left-wing groups are so mad right now. The GOP controls
the White House. You guys control the Congress.
All right, guys. I wish we could have an hour.
But hey, wait a second. Illegal aliens are paying taxes, right? So aren't they paying their own way? Well, not exactly. According to a recent report by FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, they come up with the following statistics. How many aliens are there in this country? Nobody knows for sure, of course, but they guess 12.5 million. What's the total expenditures from the total government, state, federal, local? $134 billion. What's the contribution by aliens? $18 billion. That's a net of $116 billion. That's not chump change. Where does that come from? Well, you got $1.6 billion in education, $17 billion for medical, $13 billion for legal, and $6 billion for welfare. That's a whole lot of money, and considering the fact that the federal government, well, we're broke, $20 trillion in debt, that's not good. And 45 countries represented. And no prospects of a comprehensive solution on the horizon, short of California becoming a separate state or country. Is there any hope? Well, let me end this podcast on a positive note in the form of a reasonable suggestion for a solution to the immigration problem by none other than Charles Krauthammer, author of the best-selling book, Things That Matter. All that's needed to implement this is draining the swamp, Trump to win a second term, and finally get the wall built. Oh yeah, and California needs to go Republican. Well, how about 2 out of 3 and a whole lot of prayer?
Every sensible immigration policy has 2 objectives. One, to regain control of our borders so that we decide who enters. And 2, to find a humane way to deal with the 11 million illegal immigrants who now live among us. Start with the second. For both practical and moral reasons, America cannot and will not and should not expel 11 million people. That leaves us with 2 choices. Ignore them or figure out a way to legalize them. Ignoring them hasn't worked. But there's also a huge problem with legalization. It creates an irresistible incentive for new illegal immigrants to come. We say, of course, that this will be the very last, very final, never again, we're not kidding this time, amnesty. And everyone knows it's phony. That's what was said in 1986 when we passed the Simpson-Mazzoli immigration reform. It turned out to be the largest legalization program in American history. Nearly 3 million people got permanent residency. There was no enforcement. We now have 11 million new illegal immigrants in our midst. The irony of this whole debate, which bitterly splits the country, is that there is a silver bullet that would not just solve the problem, but also create a national consensus behind it. A vast number of Americans who oppose legalization and fear new waves of immigration would change their minds if we could radically reduce new, i.e. future, illegal immigration. And we can. First, build a barrier. Call it a wall, call it a fence, call it what you will. Add cameras and sensors, add drones, beef up the patrols. All that matters is that we regain control of the border. Fences work. The triple fence outside San Diego led to a 90% reduction in infiltration. Israel's border fence with the West Bank produced a similar decline. Even holier-than-thou Europeans have conceded the point. Hungary, Macedonia, Bulgaria, Austria, Greece, Spain, Why even Norway have all started building border fences to stem the tide of Middle Eastern refugees. Then enforce two other measures, a national E-Verify system that makes it just about impossible to work if you're here illegally, and a functioning visa tracking system, since 40% of illegal immigrants are visa overstays. The wall fence will, of course, be ugly. So are the concrete barriers to keep truck bombs from driving into the White House. Sometimes function has to supersede form. And don't tell me that this is our Berlin Wall. When you build a wall to keep people in, that's a prison. When you build a wall to keep people out, that's an expression of sovereignty. Of course, no barrier will be foolproof, but it doesn't have to be. It simply has to reduce the river to a manageable trickle. Once we do, everything becomes possible, including dealing with our 11 million illegal immigrants. So let's fix that. Track the visas, do we verify, build the damn barrier. It's ridiculous to say that it can't be done. And who would certify that the border is back in our control? I would have a neutral party, perhaps a commission of retired jurists, issue the judgment. Once they do, we legalize the 11 million, granting them the right to stay and work here. We can't give them citizenship. That's a bridge too far. You don't get to join the political destiny of the country by entering it illegally. But any children born here would be American, which means that over time, the issue resolves itself. The American people are legitimately angry at the price American society has paid due to illegal immigration. But they are also a generous people. Once they're assured that we do indeed control our borders, that anger will abate. A national consensus will emerge. Radical border control followed by radical legalization. No mushy compromise. A solution requires two acts of national will. Putting up a wall along with E-Verify and visa tracking, and absorbing those who broke our laws to come to America. This is not a compromise meant to appease both sides without achieving anything. It's not some piece of hybrid legislation that arbitrarily divides illegals into those with five-year-old roots in America and those without, or some such mischief-making nonsense. If we do it right, not only will we solve the problem, we will get it done as one nation. I'm Charles Krauthammer for Prager University.
To keep our videos free, click here.